It was a cold winter day in December of 1831 when a young wife announced that her husband never returned home after leaving the night before. Or at least, that's what she claimed. You're listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can find me on social media at Cold Brew Crime to see images related to this episode. Welcome back. You're listening to episode 7 of Cold Brew, and I am thrilled to have your listening ears today. For some reason, I feel the need to send some positive energy your way today. I started this podcast in the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic back in April, and it's now the end of August, and it's still very much present. And unfortunately in Hawaii, we're back exactly where we started at the beginning. Tomorrow they begin, like a total shutdown of basically everything. The beaches are shut back down. The restaurants will no longer have dine-in. Pretty much all essential businesses only. Hair salons, nail salons, all those are closed. Not that I go there anyway, but you can't even gather here right now, they say, with anyone other than your own family. Like, even if you're in a relationship with someone that you don't live with, you're not supposed to go over to their house. Even families of 6 are supposed to separate, like, out in public. It's just craziness, I tell ya. I 100% wearing a mask, you know, out in public, using hand sanitizer and social distancing, but like, dang, this is not good for our mental well-being. So, you know, this is just me sending you some good energy and telling you that whatever you're struggling with right now, whatever burden you're walking around with, whatever worries you fall asleep with every night, you are seen, you are appreciated, and you are doing the best that you can with what you've got. Keep controlling what you can control, and when you need to crank that 90s throwback and sing it out, do it. Or, if you're like me and you need to lock yourself in a completely dark room for one moment of silence, go do it. Find something that gives you a moment of relief to ease the tension of this stressful time and to bring you back to the present. All of you mamas out there trying to homeschool, maybe even dads, I don't know, trying to homeschool and work and like pretend that you are a normal functioning adult in society right now and like nothing is wrong. You guys, you're killing it. Whether you feel like you are or not, this is a total uncharted territory. And it's okay to not have all the answers right now. It's okay to not know what you're doing. It's okay to feel stressed. It's okay to feel frustrated. And all you healthcare workers, like, holy moly, you are all still showing up for us every day with no complaints. And I just really want to say thank you. Honestly, even if you're listening to this, you're surviving a freaking pandemic. Let that sink in. Like, go give yourself some credit. Give yourself some grace. Take a minute and just, like, appreciate that we are alive. Hopefully you are well, and that we're all in this together. I pray that this strange pep talk I just attempted to give at least brings someone, you know, some type of brightness in your day, some type of hope. I don't know. Just even if I don't know your name and can't actually see you, I know someone is listening to this, and that someone is you, and I appreciate you. All right, now to awkwardly segue out of that. Let's talk about coffee. My ice is not swindling around my cup like I would like for it to, but I am taking it all the way back to App Java for this episode again, because this case is so close to home. I move home in like one literal month. And I'm just basically obsessing over home and being home and the mountains and just everything cozy and comfortable to me right now because that is what is giving me joy. So if you missed the first episode, I highly recommend you go back and listen now. But Appalachian Java is the most darling coffee shop in my hometown of Burnsville, North Carolina. They sent me a bag way back when of their Einstein blend from Ingenious Coffee Roasters, and I'm still using it. I have a very small amount left, but it's a dark roast, really full body blend. It's what they use in store for their cold brew also. And it really does produce such a dreamy cold brew, you know, taste. So thank you again to Appalachian Java for their support as always. You can keep up with their latest specials and ordering details. I know they have some online ordering options on Instagram or Facebook at Appalachian Java. One last thing before we get into the case. I don't want anybody to forget about the giveaway. And I also want to thank all of those who have already entered and left your review. They truly make my day every time I read a new one. And I also read them out loud to my husband every single time, like, so he knows, you know, that I'm doing something right. Random fact, he also doesn't listen to the podcast. He told me it's not really my genre. And I mean, I think that's probably for the better. He is really good at critiquing things and telling me when I might could do something better. So it's probably a good thing that he doesn't listen every episode. But anyways, one lucky winner will receive a Cold Brew True Crime t-shirt and a sticker. All you have to do to enter is leave me a written review on Apple Podcasts. And if you don't have an iPhone or Apple Podcasts, you could just leave a recommendation on Facebook or anywhere that allows you to leave feedback. I'll be announcing the winner on episode 10, so be on the lookout for that. And also, stickers are now available. If you want one, you can just send me a message on Instagram at Cold Brew Crime. Okay, y'all, I'll be back with the case right after this. Okay, so this episode, I feel like I need to be pretty upfront and just say that my Southern upbringing is coming in hot for this episode. You know, my accent has very much been covered up over several years of living away from home. So, you know, even when I'm talking in this podcast, I can feel myself correcting things in my mind before I say them. So definitely some phrases in here and some things I'm going to talk about where I just can't do that because it's just too close to home. So the Appalachian dialect is really unique and honestly sometimes hard to understand. My husband and I obviously are excited to go home and we've been watching these YouTube documentary type things, very poorly made documentaries, but specifically about, you know, just like mountain talk. There's an actual documentary called Mountain Talk, if you're curious, on YouTube. And also like Popcorn Sutton, which was the famous moonshiner. And just like things that remind us of home and where we came from. And like it just makes my heart swell up when I talk about it. Because it's just, the older I get, the more I realize that it's just a part of us. And I cannot wait to take my daughter back. Because she knows, honestly, nothing. I'm getting teary-eyed just talking about it. Okay. All right, let me just get back to it. So like I said, yeah, the Appalachian dialect is very unique, very hard to understand sometimes, and I often forget I have one. And then, you know, I'm out and about and someone asked me to repeat myself and I realized that I said air, but meant hour. And they're super confused. Like, where's our car? Or, yeah, that's our house. Even when I went to UNC Asheville, which was 30 minutes away from my literal childhood home, I got asked where I was from and what word I just said because they legit could not understand me. It was wild. And I really have so much to say and share about this episode, and I've had to like dial it back because I'm kind of scared that I can't even contextualize it all, and I don't want it to just be like my honest opinion. So if I throw in some random facts or a story that might not matter or whatever, just hang in there with me and just know that I'm excited to share these stories that are so close to home and they're so special to me. So this case is like a complete 180 from pretty much anything we've talked about so far for many reasons. It happened in the 1800s. It has 1 million different retellings. That's an exaggeration, but still. And I'm not even going to say any more reasons because it'll probably give it away. For those that don't know it, I don't want to give it away. Okay, let me set the scene for you and take us way back to 1831 and even farther back, honestly, in the Appalachian Mountains to Kona, North Carolina. I'm sure my hometown listeners are like, freaking finally, because they already know what this case is. Kona is located in Mitchell County, North Carolina, but in 1831, that was actually considered Burke County. And I didn't even know this, obviously, until I was researching. And at the time, back in the 1830s, 1800s, whatever, there was really only three major counties, like on the North Carolina-Tennessee line border. And now those counties, you know, that now encompasses all the smaller present day counties. So even though it was Burke County back then, it could have been Yancey, Mitchell, Watauga, Caldwell. It could have been any one of those counties because they were all in Burke County. Fun fact, my husband and I will soon be Mitchell County residents. We literally close on our first home like in 2 days, and it is a total surreal feeling. I'm terrified and so excited at the same time. So I'm just so excited to move back to those dang mountains, you know? So we're both actually Yancey County residents. Like, our driver's license legit still say that our home of record is our parents' address because we refuse to be residents of any other state. So Mitchell County, which is where this takes place, is the neighboring county to Yancey County where I grew up. So Kona, spelled K-O-N-A, is probably the smallest community you've never heard of. And don't confuse it with Kailua Kona in Hawaii, for all my Hawaii listeners. I've actually been to both, and they are very much different. So, according to Wikipedia, Kona is an incorporated community within the township of Snow Creek, within the town of Bakersville, within Mitchell County. So, you know, I understand that not everyone processes communities the same way. So this would really be like a few roads, like a few apartment buildings, honestly, like in a big city. This is a super small little area, very mountainous, very land-ish, and not a lot is happening. So Kona is located close to where the North Toe and South Toe rivers meet. And, you know, right on the county line between Mitchell and Yancey County is where you can find Kona on the Mitchell side. The closest town is at least 30 minutes away in either direction. And in my personal opinion, it's down one of the curviest roads you've ever traveled. Even though most locals still manage to drive this road with one hand on the wheel and the other out the window. So the Kona community is home to two super adorable churches that both sit on top of separate hills facing one another. I'm sure that now there are many more homes within the community, but back in 1831, I wouldn't be shocked if everyone that lived in the community was related and like either got married to each other and so on and so forth. It's really common in the mountain communities for families to all kind of stay in the same holler and build their homes, you know, on family land. And a holler or hollow is like a valley within the mountains where people live. I'm sure that's a poor explanation, but try and Google it if you're curious. So this case has a, like I said, plethora of retellings and really has become like a folklore type of tale in these small mountain communities. The downfall of that is that the facts of the case really got lost among it all. And sadly, the truth is, you know, it isn't very clear what happened. But regardless, I'm going to retell you the story as best I can, and we'll really try to emphasize what we know is fact and what we don't. So it's 1831. It's right before Christmas on December 22nd in Kona, North Carolina. There's a beautiful snow blanketing the Appalachian Mountains, like, you know, back when it snowed on Christmas. What a time. And Francis Stewart Silver, better known as Frankie, was home in her mountain cabin with her 13-month-old baby, Nancy, and her husband, Charlie, had failed to return home. Or that's what she said. It seemed that Charlie and Frankie, you know, were kind of meant to be. Like, they were nearly the perfect couple. They'd only been married for a few years, but everything kind of just seemed like it was falling into place, and they were great. They settled down in their own little cabin in 1830. Their families had settled on opposite sides of the mountain ridge 20 years earlier. So, you know, they were just like walking, found each other one day, walking across the mountain ridge, and were like, oh, hey. And that was that. Frankie was described as petite, bright eyes, fair skin, blonde hair. She had a lot of charm and was very witty. Her family had settled in the mountains when she was between the ages of 6 and 10. It was kind of, you know, I read both of those ages, so we're just going to make that broad 4 years. And like I said, just across the ridge from where Charlie's family lived. Charles Silver, or Charlie, was 19 at the time and is described as the kind of the life of the party guy. He could keep people talking and laughing. He even played a few instruments. He was strong, healthy, and fairly good looking. You know, he had dark features and a fair complexion. Some say that he was out hunting on the Tow River, where others say he had gone out to get the Christmas liquor, which would have 100% been moonshine, and, you know, this would have been a decent trip in the snow either way, considering he would have either been on foot or on horseback. This would have been treacherous, I feel like, but, like, you'll do anything for Christmas liquor, you know? So, frankly, simply said, he lit out in the snow last night and never came home. Period. Family and officials searched for days, and after no luck of finding Charlie or any, you know, trace of Charlie, an older man in the community named Jake Cullis, or Collis, I found both names, so I'm not sure which one's accurate, he was stated to be a trapper, like a wild game trapper. He was really curious about it all. Like, he had I feel like he was like the detective back in the day. And he really felt like there were more clues inside the cabin than what Frankie was letting on. So he decided to investigate himself. And a few articles stated that he actually went inside the home while Frankie was gone. And obviously today, you can't do that without a search warrant or whatever. So I have no idea if he got the local law enforcement involved in the search or how he got this to hold up legally, but Jake and a few other men ended up going inside the cabin to search for other clues. And, you know, maybe even Frankie gave him permission. We don't actually know. Like, she could have been like, yeah, go search for whatever you want, because she thought they wouldn't find anything. So, I don't know. In my head, I'm playing it out like a thriller movie and that he snuck in there and was on edge the whole time waiting for someone to walk in. I'm sure that's not what happened, but whatever. So, one thing that Jake did once he got in there was he took some of the ashes from the fireplace and he put them in a bowl of water. He claimed that the ashes were too greasy. And personally, I don't know much about ashes and fireplaces and how ashes of one thing might be different than another when submerged in water, but I'm assuming that ashes of, let's say, wood wouldn't be greasy, whereas ashes of some type of meat, per se, might produce some oily substance when submerged in water, you know? So a different article read that they actually found bone and teeth in the fireplace. So I can't truthfully tell you which way it went. There's literally so many articles, so many retellings, just trying to lay it all out there. The men then proceeded to pull some of the flooring in front of the fireplace up. I guess something led them to believe something was underneath. I don't know what. One article stated that they just found a large blood stain, but another stated that there was actually some body parts buried beneath the floorboard, like under the ground. Upon further investigation, outside the cabin, they discovered some strange things buried in a hollow stump. It looked like bits of bone and a heel iron that they said belonged to Charlie. A heel iron is kind of just like a horseshoe on the heel of a boot, and I guess that was a thing back then. And also additionally, they found more body parts buried in the yard nearby. It was believed that Frankie had killed Charlie with an axe. She had chopped up his body and then attempted to burn parts of it and buried the rest. Yep, you heard that right. And, you know, she did all of this as a really tiny woman with an axe and basically a baby on her hip. Because, like I said, she was at home with her 13-month-old baby. So, you know, like, I mean, hopefully the baby was sleeping during this horrific scene, but there's a high possibility she wasn't. Frankie was arrested for first-degree murder in January of 1832 and taken to jail in Morganton. Morganton is the county seat of Burke County, so that's where the courthouse was and all of that. By March, a jury had indicted her, and the trial was set. One article stated that Frankie's mother, Barbara, and brother, Blackston, were also arrested, and it was thought that they helped Frankie cover up the murder because, again, everyone had a really hard time understanding how Frankie herself could have done all of this. The charges against Barbara and Blackston, however, were dropped on January 17th. Frankie's trial quickly became the talk of the town. No one could believe that she could have committed this gruesome act. Pretty much immediately, there began to be rumors about the motive behind this crime. Some people say that Charlie was actually, you know, an abusive alcoholic and that Frankie probably killed him in his sleep because she was super over it. One story went that he left to get the Christmas liquor, started drinking it on the way back, and by the time he got back to the cabin, Frankie was probably really annoyed that he was drunk and started yelling at him. The baby could have been crying. And, you know, he just started yelling and pushing her around. And she just grabbed the closest thing she could, which happened to be a wood cutting axe, and just hit him with it out of self-defense. Because she was basically, you know, like over it at that point. Was like, you're really not hurting me anymore. Goodbye. Obviously, though, in 1832, women really weren't favored much. So the chances of Frankie pleading self-defense and getting off were pretty slim because even then, defendants, especially women defendants, weren't even allowed to take the stand in their own defense until around 1880. Frankie's attorney and her father both actually agreed that she should plead not guilty and, you know, try to let the state prove her guilt. And of course, that just really didn't go well for Frankie. The all-male jury, insert eye roll emoji, came back with a unanimous vote of guilty, and the judge sentenced her to be hung by the neck until she be dead. Quoted right out the newspaper. Once convicted, several appeals were filed, but they all failed. Women all throughout Burke County even came together to ask the governor, you know, to show some mercy. Once it all came to light that she might have murdered in self-defense, they were like, whoa, we got to do something about this. And sadly, nothing worked. Frankie was still awaiting her execution. Naturally, Frankie's father decided to break her out of jail. Like, why you gotta go be doing all this? You know, her execution date kept getting postponed, kind of, and he was over it. He was tired of waiting. So the embellished story about this goes that her father paid the guard of the jail. He broke Frankie out at night, cut her hair, and dressed her in men's clothing to disguise her. Frankie rode out of town in like a load of hay, and they headed towards the Tennessee border. Obviously, they were caught pretty quickly on the way to Tennessee, and the sheriff supposedly stopped them and addressed the disguised, you know, person, the person that really looked like a girl, you know, as Frankie. Was like, "Hey, Frankie." And Frankie replied, "Thank you, sir, but my name is Tommy." And one of the other men with them, trying to be helpful, yelled out, "Yeah, her name's Tommy." It's like, dang it. So Frankie was immediately taken back to the jailhouse and chained to the floor and continued to wait for her execution. At this point, the women of Morganton really kind of put together their own appeal for one final attempt to save Frankie. But again, it didn't work. And Frankie was hanged on July 12th, 1833, from the limb of a huge oak tree that stood on a hill above the courthouse in Morganton. It was a sunny and warm day, and it's rumored that when asked if she had any final words, Frankie's father yelled out over the large crowd, "Die with it in you, Frankie!" And she did. No one will ever know exactly what happened that cost Charlie Silver his life on that winter day, but in the 1960s, one man set out to find the truth. Author and journalist Perry Dean Young discovered all the appeal and petition documents while in college at Chapel Hill. He began his own investigation into what really happened back in 1831. In his book, The Untold Story of Frankie Silver, he produces all of the documents that prove Frankie was unjustly hanged. Young goes on to debunk a lot of the legends surrounding Frankie and Charlie. The legend is that she was the first or only white woman ever hanged in North Carolina, that she sang a confession from the scaffold. It is also believed that the 20th century song Frankie and Johnny was based on the couple, but it was actually based on a different murder that happened in St. Louis. Young stated in an interview in 2012 that there is ample evidence from the time to prove that her husband was loading his gun to kill her and she picked up the axe to defend herself. He continues to say she also did not sneak up on him while he was sleeping. She killed in self-defense. She was not the first or only woman ever hanged in North Carolina. She was one of at least 15. She did not read or sing a confession from the scaffold. A young school teacher even plagiarized a Kentucky ballad, had it printed, and handed it out at the hanging. And sadly, people have been taking that as fact and written by Frankie for all these years, even though Frankie was more than likely illiterate. Young continues to state that while researching in college, he came across 17 different letters and petitions to the governor asking for pardon for Frankie. In these documents, it clearly spelled out that Charlie Silver was a drunk, abusive husband, and Frankie killed him in self-defense. After the execution, Frankie's father already had a coffin ready to take her back, you know, home. One thing, however, they didn't account for was the hot July sun that would rapidly decompose the body. They were forced to bury Frankie 8 miles outside of Morganton on Old Buckthorn Tavern Road, and a headstone was placed on what is assumed to be her grave in 1952, but today the gravesite is still fairly difficult to find. Charlie Silver was buried in the Silver Family Cemetery behind the Kona Baptist Church. Pieces of his body were found at different times, and back then it would have been improper to reopen the grave. So there's 3 separate grave sites for Charlie today. What about this baby? Like, we're going through all this and it's like, there was still a baby. So there's really not much documentation about Nancy's early life. After the death of her parents when she was 13 months old, it's believed that Frankie did not want the baby being raised by Charlie's family. So Frankie's dad had arranged for his brother and his brother's wife to come get the baby. They were from a small town in Macon County near Franklin, Tennessee, called Ellie J. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I've never heard of it. So, you know, there's actually a book written by family members of Nancy called A Life for Nancy, which documents Nancy's life, They also have a Facebook page, and there's about 2,000 posts with a ton of family history. I highly recommend you go give it a scroll because it was, you know, you get go down the rabbit hole quick. Sadly, tragedy seemed to follow Nancy throughout her whole life. She had two marriages that we know of. Her first husband died during the Civil War, and her second husband supposedly raped her daughter, and then Nancy forced him to leave. After this, she changed her name back to her first married name, Parker, and she had several kids and has a long list of grandkids that followed. Nancy Silver Parker died in 1901 at the age of 70 and is buried at Mount Grove Cemetery in Macon County. Growing up in Western North Carolina and, you know, being in these small mountain communities, I learned about the Ballad of Frankie early, you know, like in elementary school, but sadly, it's really just a folklore story passed down from generations and kind of told during reading time versus the true facts of the case. Just in my research, I've changed my own opinion of what actually happened, and I learned a lot that I didn't know. It's crazy, really, how these stories, these legends, are never really corrected over time. Things people learn and hear about as kids stick with them. And until you do your own research, you'll never really think different. If you're listening and you grew up hearing this story, I would really love to know how it was told to you. You know, I really want to know all the different variations. And if you believe that Frankie killed Charlie out of jealousy, or if you were told it was self-defense, who's to know who's right? Cold Brew is recorded, edited, and produced by me. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew True Crime Podcast wherever you listen. Don't forget to enter the giveaway. All you need to do is leave me a written review on Apple Podcasts, and I'll be announcing the winner on episode 10. You can send any questions or comments about this episode to me on social media at Cold Brew Crime. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode.